Jesus calming the seas, the miracles of Matthew 14:22-34 and John 6:16-21.
One of those aspects of this is we would love to read all these verses together, but we trust that you'll be familiar enough with it, and each of the brothers will probably make reference along the way to the verses as they see fit. But when I looked at the aspect to set the stage a little bit, let me put it that way, to set the stage a little bit, Jesus had just got done feeding the 5,000. He wanted to go up into the mountain and commune with the Heavenly Father himself. So he sent his disciples before him across the sea to Gennesaret, and he was implying that he would meet them on the other side. Now, one point of interest is that you can read in some of the accounts and get the impression there was only one boat, because the multitudes also were looking for a ship, and they were wondering what happened, and they wanted to follow him. The miracles he did in feeding them was fantastic, and they would like to follow him for that, and we learn later that they did try to catch up with him. But nonetheless, that implies that when Jesus is saying, you take the boat, there's one there, I'll meet you on the other side, that somehow he intentionally knew he was going to get there. We know he got there by walking partway on the water, which will be addressed, and the rest of the way after he got in the boat with them. So Jesus, in one sense, was setting that stage. But when he went up into the mountain to pray, it said it was dark, it was night, and yet the storm came up. John records that it was a great wind. And so the great wind was blowing, and it created this tempest of the waves on that sea. So much so that if that was a boat that had a sail, they weren't able to use it, because it tells us they tried rowing to shore. So they, nonetheless, could not use the sail. They had to make their own efforts at rowing to try to make land, have some control of the ship, and this is when Jesus came to them. So we want to draw some lessons from this observation. Now, there's one aspect that we might start with to say you could see almost, as it were, a prophetic picture in this to a certain extent. That during at the first advent, Jesus was present with the disciples, and then he said, I must go away to prepare a place for you, and I will return from you again. And so he left. In our picture here, he went up into the mountain. That would be like ascending up into the heavens. And throughout the gospel age, his disciples, his followers, have been struggling through the storm-tossed sea of the consecrated walk during this permission of evil, with a great wind, which is represented. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. He could create this great tempest wind that would stir the masses, the restless, irreligious masses of mankind, which is the sea, to create all the trouble that the new creatures are passing through during this gospel age. But Mark accounts, which is of interest, this record is in Mark 6, verses 45 through 52 to accompany the Matthew 14 and John 6. Mark account relates that Jesus saw them struggling in rowing when he was still in the mountain, before he had ever gone there. So I like the thought with that, that that goes along with what Jesus said at the close of Matthew's gospel, Matthew 28, that, lo, I am with you till the end of the age. So in one hand, Jesus is actually absent in the heavenly courts as a divine spirit being, but he is continually with this future bride throughout the gospel age, observing all our needs and tending to us as that faithful high priest to his under priest throughout the entire gospel age, until he would actually return. And he actually returns to earth's atmosphere as a glorified spirit being, invisible to us, but he does actually return for his bride. And they meet him in the air, that is, in the atmosphere. Greek word is atmosphere. So with this, we think that's when Jesus went out to meet them in the boat and calm the seas. It would be after his return at the second advent. Now, that's a general picture. It's an overview picture. But there's a verse in Luke 21, I'd like to turn there and read this, where it gives us one aspect of interpretation to the storm-tossed sea. Luke 21, and then we'll start in verse 25. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity on account of, King James says, the sea, but the Greek reads better, on account of the sea and the waves roaring. Men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming upon the earth, for the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then they shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when those things begin to come to pass, then look up, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. So the irony is the very extreme disruption that the earth is experiences at the time upon our Lord's return during this parousia, as he's foretelling us, the point is that those are one of the evidences of his return, because this is starting to disrupt Satan's control. But the very thing that's disturbing the masses of mankind would be the very thing that for us we should lift up our heads and rejoice, because it means that that much nearer to the peaceable kingdom when he would rule with the rod of iron and make everything into a state of peace for the world of mankind. But I thought of this verse, the seas and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear. And that reminded me of our poor disciples out on that ship when the waves were so terrible, their hearts were failing them for these fears. Now, with that, I wanted to bring it into this context prophetically, because this is a time we're living in. So we could have somewhat of a similar experience if our faith and our relationship to the Heavenly Father and Jesus doesn't keep our hearts secure and our minds at peace with him, even though men all about us, people all around us, are suffering great fears and difficulties because they're seeing the removal of this old heavens and the old earth while they're still here. So there's, as it were, kind of a prophetic aspect. But we're going to focus more on what we consider to be a personal understanding of what took place there. Now, it's true, we like to think of disciples as having faith, and they did, because remember, they left all in order to follow Jesus the Master. Now, they weren't spirit-begotten yet. They had a lot to learn, as it were, and all that is true. But here they are, they're following his instructions, they rode out into the sea without him, and I, on one hand, think that maybe the adversary saw this as an opportunity to try to do them in, try to drown them, sink their boat. Jesus wasn't with them, and he thought, well, maybe I'll get behind this. And you'll read that in some of the reprint articles where Brother Russell thinks that Satan was behind this great storm. However, it was an opportunity for Jesus to demonstrate a miracle that's rather unique. And I want you just to stop and think for a moment. How many miracles did Jesus do that controlled the elements? Particularly, how many miracles did Jesus do to save his disciples? Not many, if you can even think of one. Most of his miracles were done on behalf of others. Not all, but most. But here's one where he controlled the elements, which we think is demonstrating he has control, that he can either stop or mitigate Satan's influences or Satan's minions' influences over us. And that's where Brother Russell writes in one of the comments, remember, I believe it's a manna, but it might be a Songs of the Night, but he said, we're almost immortal until it's our time is done, that we might have made our calling and election sure. So that's one of those things. Satan cannot overthrow us unless we ourselves come out from underneath the Lord's protection by not following the things that we should. So that should be a great reassurance to us. Now, when the disciples were rowing, that reminded me that quite often when we find ourselves in affliction or confusion or despair, the first thing we do is we start to make our own efforts. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. But if our own efforts are unavailing, because the conditions are superior or greater than what we control. And that was the condition with the sea. They could row all they want, but the environment they were in was greater. Their circumstances were out of their control. And their feeble efforts weren't able to control it. That is where, when we realize that the situation we are in that's causing us this kind of perplexity or confusion or consternation or whatever struggle it is, that's where our faith is to be our bastion. That it is to be our bulwark. That where we recognize, Lord, this is greater than me. This is beyond what I can control. But I know you can. I'm not sure how yet in this circumstance, but I cast myself completely upon your care and your providences in this. It's that time where we can have a little mental discipline and say to ourselves, why am I trying to control that which I can't control? Why am I so anxious over that which I have no control over? But the Lord does. And he's overruling for my good if I can but get his perspective. If I can get his perspective. Now, getting the heavenly perspective. Getting the heavenly perspective when our old man is struggling, that is a challenge. Now, I want to interject two more scriptures here in this. One of them is going to be found in 2 Corinthians, and it is Second Corinthians 7, and Paul writes, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side, with outward fightings, within were fears. With outward fightings, within were fears. Brethren, there can be the storms without. That's in the circumstance and environment around us. But at times we have storms within. It's up here. And the storm within, like so often is the case, is the one we dread most. Because it's what we're having to deal with internally. And Paul is writing that he had fightings within. He had struggles within himself. And it was at times like this that we appreciate that even the great apostle Paul, with all his faith, he still was working through the old man for a brain and for an adrenaline system and adrenal glands and for everything else that goes wacky. When we find ourselves super distressed or stressed or depressed, which is just an organic breakdown of the fallen human condition. And we suffer that. But that's where the new creature is trying to rise above it. But brethren, sometimes we can make ourselves unduly guilty as if we're lacking faith because the new creature can't control this human flesh the way we would like. And even Paul has written, right? Romans 7, the things that I would do, I do not. Oh, wretched man that I am, who's going to deliver me from this body of the flesh? But in the mind, I serve the law of God, but in the flesh, the law of sin. The point being, very simply, is Paul's acknowledging, even with his great faith, I can't control the storms that are always going on within me. However, by faith, I do trust to God and the Son of God that they will bring about the deliverance. Now, Jesus himself, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he wept. Hebrews 5. Paul wasn't there, but yet in Hebrews 5, Paul writes that Jesus cried with tears when he besought the heavenly fathers in prayer and supplication. He didn't want to die eternally. He wasn't afraid of dying. He knew he had to do that. He was willing to do that. He wanted to have assurance that he had done all things right so that he could live again with the Father. He wanted to go home and be with him. He wanted to be successful in the mission that he was given. But the account reads in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke that he was amazed in that garden. My soul is nigh unto death. And with that, he found no comfort with the disciples. They couldn't comfort him. They couldn't give him the answer he sought. But the thing of it is, Jesus was a perfect human being, but he wasn't a superhuman being. He was a perfect human being. He had the same human systems that we struggle with. And he was feeling anxious because his flesh was anxious, because he wanted to be sure he had done everything right. He didn't lack faith in the Father. And he never failed. And he never sinned. So why do the Gospels and then Paul in Hebrews 5 give us the insight that Jesus had these struggles in the flesh where there was an anxiousness in doing his Father's will perfectly? I think it's because Paul also writes in Hebrews, the 4th chapter, that we have a high priest that is touched with the things that we struggle with, so that we can have confidence that the one that we're trusting in has had an experience of the new creature gaining the mastery over the flesh. With him, it was still perfect flesh. He gained a mastery over the flesh that when he had a sense he was doing the Father's will and all was right, then he was the calmest of the calm the rest of that night and through the remainder of the day. So, brethren, with us, we always want to increase our faith indeed. Even the apostles, you know, the disciples, Lord, increase our faith. And it's stated that as your faith is, so be it unto you. When Jesus healed the two blind men that came to him, that was his answer. As your faith is, so be it unto you. So you and I, brethren, when we find ourselves in these storms, whether they're within, whether they're without, we want to fall back on remembering the various ways in which the Lord's providences has overruled in our past experiences. So we set up the Ebenezers. We've got our reminder stones of how the Lord gave us the victory in times past when we have these struggles. And there's a certain sense at times where we just say, this is going to be tough, but I know from the past experience, I'm going to come out on the other side if I just wait on the Lord. And then we have to sometimes tough it out with our body acting in ways that we are very uncomfortable with, that we struggle with, that we have the trials with, but nonetheless, our faith keeps us in that narrow way, and we keep pressing on. And I like to also think that sometimes we learn by observation to help strengthen our faith. We observe how our other brethren handle their experiences, and that's a learning, that's a blessed assistance to us in learning. That's part of what an instructor teaches their class, is what they personally experience, then they know how to share it to their students. They benefit. But I remember that there was 12 in the boat, right? Don't you think that those 12 reminded each other later about how the Lord controlled the very wind, the calm, the sea? Don't you remember that? So for 11 of them, for sure, 11, they did remember it. And who knows how often later on in their experiences they looked at one another in their hardships, and they said, remember how the Lord could control the wind and the waves, and he was with us. And like, last thought, before I step off, Mark account reads that when Jesus walked on the water, it was as if he was going to walk by them. I'll meet you on the other side. And he walked by them. The other account, in Matthew, he entered the boat. Now, Brother Obi is going to address this, but I just want to make that simple observation. It's when Jesus entered the boat that they were the most settled and calmed. So with you and I, the closer our personal relationship is with Jesus, the more readily we'll have that sense of calm. The more he's at a distance, we see him as if it were afar off, the less calmness and assurance we're going to have.